All right, well, thanks very much for having me.
Is your mic off?
Yeah, I'm all mic'd up. I should be good to go. So I guess I want to first start by plugging in my clicker here so that actually works. But yeah, I want to acknowledge first the people that really did the work on this. So this is a collection of current and former members in my group. So Chris and Rory here did a lot of the work with the deep reinforcement learning. Irene, Kevin, and Kyle. Irene's a co-op student who's gone back to UBC. These guys are PhD students in my lab. They did a lot of the work with the extensive deep neural networks. And then Elizabeth and Amber did some of the work with sort of conventional machine learning. And then Ezra has been a big help recently in sort of doing the time series stuff. I won't talk about it today. Shiva and Natalia are both former postdocs. The problem that I've realized in this field is it's really hard to keep postdocs. So as soon as they learn what you're doing, they go out and they make a ton of money in industry. So they, I think collectively, they maybe lasted a year. So, but Vladimir is, so they're doing really well. Anyway, so Vladimir is doing the work as well on the reinforcement learning. And so I am not an AI deep learning guy. So, you know, once upon a time, I worked on problems that kind of looked like this. So this is the kind of work that I did in my PhD and my postdoc, which was sort of computational physics and chemical physics. And so what that meant in practice was sort of doing calculations on a computer of an interesting system, either that could be sort of realized at extreme conditions. So my PhD was on high pressure research, trying to figure out how matter behaved at extreme conditions. Or kind of looking at the electronic structure of different types of interfaces. So sort of organic electronics, self-assembly, light harvesting, this kind of stuff. And so this is kind of the world that I still sort of live in some sense, that when I go to conferences, invariably, the people that I'm talking to in the audience are used to hearing about stuff like this. You know, what is the level alignment? How do these things come together? And so, you know, the past little while, it's sort of, you know, how do I explain what I'm trying to do now to a group of people who are used to hearing about this? And so about 2 years ago, I was actually at a conference, like, you know, talking about this kind of stuff in Hong Kong. And it just so happened, you know, when you go to Hong Kong at a conference, sometimes they'll take you around the city and they'll show you these things. And so the night before my presentation, we went down to the harbor. And I did the millennial thing, like I took a picture of a boat, you know, I put it up on Instagram, and you know, this is how I remembered it. And I went back to my hotel, and I thought, well, maybe this picture is actually the way that I can communicate to people the thing that I'm trying to do. So what did I do? I took my Instagram type picture, and I uploaded it to the internet. And so, you know, everybody here has probably heard of Wolfram. So Wolfram has something they call the Image Identification Project. And I said, well, what can Wolfram tell me about this photograph? And so Wolfram comes back and says, it's a light ship. I don't even know what a light ship was. So I went on Wikipedia, and Wikipedia tells me that a light ship is a ship or a vessel which acts like a lighthouse. And you go back and you look at it and you go, oh, okay, I kind of see how it got there. And so then the next thing I ask myself is like, well, what does Google think about this picture? So I took the same picture and I uploaded it, you know, to Google Images. And then this is what Google comes back with. So if you look at this for a second, you realize it's actually the same harbor and the same type of ship. And at first when I saw this, I was kind of awestruck. And I thought, oh no, there must be some sort of funny business going on here. So I tore out the metadata from the photograph. I SSH'd back to a machine in Canada so there wouldn't be any sort of geolocation. And you know, I really tried to tear it apart. But no, this is actually the current state of computer vision. And so I told my mother this, and she goes, yes, Isaac, you know, this is what computers do. But for people other than my mother, I think we all need to, this is kind of a big deal, right? So like 10 years ago, if you had gone to the Valley, and you said, I'm gonna build a machine that you can take a picture of, and it's gonna know what it is, find similar things, and feed it back to you in, you know, like 500 milliseconds, you would have been laughed out of the Valley. And yet had, you know, those investors spent a little bit of money on you, you would have been worth a lot of money. So if you've been sort of following the field of AI, you'll know that this is sort of one of these great successes. Another one which got a lot of sort of fame recently was the victory of AlphaGo over Lee DeSole. So I feel really bad for this guy, because I imagine that his face must be in a lot of PowerPoint presentations as sort of like, you know, the last fall for humanity. So if you weren't already aware, so AlphaGo, which is a piece of software which was written by DeepMind, a company that's now been acquired by, I guess Alphabet would be the correct thing. So they came up with an algorithm, a deep reinforcement cue learning agent, that was able to best a 9-Don Go master in a 4 out of 5 series. And actually, this version of AlphaGo now, as impressive as it was at the time, this is kind of like is nothing now as far as DeepMind is concerned. So they've got something called AlphaGo Zero, which can totally trounce AlphaGo. And so basically, you know, what was previously called sort of a grand challenge problem in AI and the solution, this is kind of peanuts compared to what exists now. So the field is evolving extremely rapidly, and we're starting to knock off some pretty important problems. And if you're old enough to remember what things were like back in, I think it was 97 when Kasparov lost to Deep Blue, Go was a fundamentally different problem. So chess is kind of easy in the sense that you can just buy a computer that's big enough and you can grind through all the possibilities and you'll win. You can't do that with games like Go. So we really are starting to see something that's fundamentally different. The same team that did this work on Go, they also sort of played a different type of game, namely that of Atari. So they're, in this particular paper, what they showed is that you can take an agent and you can connect it to sort of old school Atari games. And in the beginning, when it first starts playing, it doesn't even know the rules, it doesn't know what the situation is, and it's kind of terrible at it. You know, sometimes, you know, it misses a lot. But as the agent keeps playing the game and is allowed to play the game, it learns through each episode and it gets better and better and better. So after about 400 episodes, you know, it's maybe as good as I would be at the game. But if you let it just keep playing, eventually it maxes out. And so these things will learn optimal strategies within a game. So in this case, it's basically drill a hole into the top of Atari or the Bricklit game, and then you can rack up the points. There was a result that came out recently. There's a game called Qbert, and so Qbert, you know, it's this little guy hops around and gets some point. A version of this game found a bug in the game where Qbert can hop around in a particular pattern and then all of a sudden gets infinity points. And so they had to fix the game in order to keep the agent learning because it was just, it was learning how to play too well. People have also, again, going back to chess, so, you know, Kasparov, Deep Blue was a big deal. IBM spent a lot of money on that. And I guess what happened a couple months ago is someone at DeepMind got bored and they just spun up chess. And within 24 hours of playing, they had developed an AI that became the best chess player ever. So, you know, in light of that, I started to think, so if this stuff exists, like, honestly, how hard can quantum mechanics be, right? Because, you know, as a physicist, we like to tell people, like, we do our thing is difficult, like it's challenging. No one can solve this stuff, right? But at the end of the day, like, you know, this is just a partial differential equation. Like, I get that it's a hard one and so on and so forth, but let's maybe see what we can do to tackle that. So in the sort of the world that I lived in a previous life, the go-to method of solving the Schrodinger equation was something called density functional theory. And so most of my talk is actually going to be based around sort of applying methods around that. And so if you're not already familiar with it, DFT is a formally exact method which shows that you can actually, you know, when you teach students about quantum mechanics, you say, you know, the wave function is everything. Once you have that, you know everything about the system, which is true. But Homberg-Cohn theorem, so this is back in the 60s, actually showed that the wave function itself is a highly inefficient data structure. So I heard Roger say that, you know, what is the wave function is the ultimate big data. I'm going to make the argument, yeah, that, so we're going to patent the wave function here at Perimeter. This is fantastic. Okay. I'm going to actually argue that, you know, I agree, but actually it's a very redundant data structure. So a wave function is something that is very easy to query in terms of, like, if you were imagining writing a MySQL query to a wave function, it's pretty straightforward. But it's a complex object, whereas actually Homberg-Cohn theorem tells you that you can contain the same amount of information with the ground state electron density, it's just much harder to query. And the reason that that I'm going to talk about DFT is because if you ever sort of log into the computers, you know, that exist around here, or you know, shared with your colleagues in condensed matter, you'll maybe recognize some of the software. This stuff gets used a lot. So NVIDIA, a couple years ago, I'm pretty sure they were trying to sell graphics cards when they were doing this survey, but they went around to all the supercomputing centers in the world in the top 500, and they actually came up with an interesting number, which is about 15% of worldwide high-performance computing time is actually spent on a single piece of software called VASP. And this is one, you know, one of many that that are able to do what DFT can do. And so we spend millions and millions of hours every month just grinding away on effectively partial differential equations. And the reason that people do it is because it's, you know, it's relatively accurate and cheap. And so do I mean by accurate and cheap. Suppose you're trying to design some new material or a drug or something of this nature, and you kind of want to know, like, you know, what's the bond length going to be? You know, how much energy does it cost to break it apart? Things of this nature. Density functional theory is a way that you can get at it. And the reason that I kind of think like it is it, so it tells you it's this theory that maps the ground state electron density to physical observables of a system. The problem is that we can't read the map. Okay, so I like to goof off a lot at work. You know, and a number of years ago, I kind of developed a coping strategy to like deal with my goof off time, which is I started doing scientific visualizations. So back in 2006, I was a summer student, actually at Livermore Lab while I was a grad student, and I was working on you know, metallic hydrogen, my first love. And so, you know, during my goof off time, I would start to do visualizations of hydrogen. And so what this is an actual visualization of data that you would get from one of these electronic structure type calculations. And so what you can see here, the sort of the outer part of the circle here, this is an isosurface of the ground state electron density, so there's not a lot of electron here, it's like a topography map. And then the blue stuff here, this is sort of, there's more electron there, right? So just as you were kind of walking around a mountain. This is one way you can visualize electronic structure data. Another way that you can visualize the same data is just as a volume slice. Right? Lots of electrons in the covalent bond, not a lot electron here. And generally speaking, when people are doing sort of material science or computational chemistry type questions, what they're asking are questions like, you know, what wavelengths of light does this thing absorb at? What are the forces between the atoms? And so on. And so we have these data structures within our computer, and they're stored in some sort of basis or grid. Okay. So this was the world that I lived in. And so I guess we'll take you a little back in history. So, you know, Roger was saying, so I did a postdoc at Berkeley Lab and then a Livermore Lab. And it's funny, when you tell someone's life story sort of sequentially, you sort of figure they had a plan the whole way. Like, it kind of makes sense, right? Well, that was not, so I'm not going to lie to you. So back in 2011 as a postdoc, everybody who was a postdoc was freaking out because we thought there were no jobs. And we lived in the Bay Area, and word on the street was that data science, this is how you were going to get a job. So myself and a buddy of mine, we spun up Coursera, and we said, we're going to learn how to be data scientists. Okay, this is the plan. And so we took one of these machine learning courses, actually one of the first ones from Andrew Ng. And if you've done these courses, you'll recognize this data set here. Okay, so this is what's called the MNIST training set. And so what MNIST is NIST, who is what is it, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which is, you know, a lab of which NRC has a similar function as one of the things that we do. They went ahead and they collected a whole bunch of standardized tests that had been written by children and, you know, people in the military, and they scanned them into a computer, and then they individually labeled them and provided these as a data set for machine learning. And so this is something that you can actually go on the internet and get. So if you want to get, like, you know, 10,000 copies of the number 5, that's a thing you can do. And you download this thing, and you're going to get it on a grid, right? So it's like 28 pixels by 28 pixels, and it's sort of 0 to 255 tells you the color. And the reason that they wanted to do this is because they said, we want to solve, you know, the zip code problem. So when I lived in California, my zip code was 94705. You want to be able to send me some mail, and I want to have optical character recognition to solve the problem. And so then you say, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if I had a box, which I showed a picture, okay, so here's my box, and then it's going to tell me that, oh yeah, this is the number 5, because it's, you know, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, this is a 5. And if I show it a 7, I'll say this is a 7. You know, and a 0, it's a 0, and so on, and so on, and so on. And after enough, you know, training, this algorithm can start to accurately classify the data. So how do you build this box? The answer is there's a number of different ways that you can do it. One of the ways that's probably gained a lot of popularity in recent years are these things called artificial neural networks. And if you're not already familiar with how they work, I'll tell you quickly. So basically, you have this building block here, which is a neuron. So it takes data, this x1, x2, and x3, and I'm gonna multiply each one of these numbers by some weight, and I'm gonna put it into a function, which either goes between 0 and 1, or if it's ReLU, sort of, it's unbounded. And I'm gonna make a graph where I sort of, you know, in the case of this one, for just a simple feedforward artificial neural network, I'm gonna unfold this vector, so these are my input layers. I make all these connections here with some hidden layers, and then I feed forward to the right side of the graph, and in this particular case, I wanna twiddle the weights such that when I show a picture of the number 7, this light bulb turns on and the rest of these things turn off, okay? There are many ways to solve the problem, but this is one of them. And so if you're a physicist or an engineer, you know, this is kind of curve fitting, and the answer is yes, of course, exactly, but it's really good. So the thing that we're doing in my group now is we're saying, well, if this works for like handwriting, why can't I apply this to materials and molecules? I have some electron cloud, I wanna feed it into a box, and I wanna get physical observables. And so those might mean things like kinetic energy, it might mean forces, and so on. And if you're sort of a density functional type person, you go, well, wait a minute, this thing is just a function. So this is the crazy idea that I had a couple years ago. And I thought, I came into the group, it was a Tuesday, we still refer to it as Crazy Tuesday, where I told all of the graduate students, drop what you're doing, all of your projects are done, we are no longer doing this anymore, we're doing a new thing. And so as you can imagine, they were terrified, you know what I mean? People were starting to find out if they could change schools. But we said, no, we're gonna do this crazy thing. And so I thought, all right, if I'm gonna throw my career away, I probably wanna make sure that we at least have the opportunity for a parachute. So why don't we choose something where this has to work? What's the easiest thing that I can imagine where if this doesn't work, I can still kind of like climb back on the aircraft and try and get into the publishing game again? And so we said, well, let's choose a really simple toy model. And as a physicist, there exists one toy, and it's called the Ising model. And so this is just a classical Ising model. Which, what do we have here? So we've got some nearest neighbor interaction, and in general, it can be an interaction with a field. And the reason that I like this thing is because I can think about it as these little pictures. So these are these checkerboards. The question is, how can I use this deep neural network stuff to do things with these pictures? So why do physicists like Ising models? Basically, because it's the simplest thing that gives you a phase transition, right? So when, you know, when a child asks you how magnetism works, the first thing that you do is you pick up a paperclip, you pick up a magnet, and then you start sort of drawing the paperclip along with the magnet. You say, okay, inside of this paperclip, there are these domains, and as I go like this, we're aligning the domains, and then you take the paperclip and you hang it on a piece of metal, and it sticks, and you go, now you have understood magnetism. And the child says, thank you very much. Right, that's how magnets work, it's domains. So there's of course, a second part of the experiment, which you know you can do if you work at NRC, which is you take that paperclip and you put it into an oven and you heat it, the paperclip, to over 1,000 Kelvin. And what you will find is that the paperclip will actually go through a continuous phase transition from one where magnetization is stable at finite temperature to where you lose the net magnetization. So you can sort of reset the domains and you go into a disordered state. And the temperature at which it does this is called the Curie temperature. And we like this thing because we can understand phase transitions. You can solve it analytically. So what do you actually do in terms of machine learning? Well, we're gonna need some data. So the first thing that we do is we generate a whole bunch of data. So in sort of conventional machine learning, I would call these things the features. So these are my zero or my negative ones or ones. And then I'm gonna have labels, which are the energy of a configuration or the magnetization of the configuration. And so then we say, right, how do I neural network this thing? Well, let's just try what they did with the handwriting recognition. So we went on the internet and we just downloaded one of these good nets. So this is called LENET, so Yan LeCun, who's now one of the big AI guys at Facebook. Bengio's on this. This is a super famous paper. And we literally just grabbed this net from the internet without any understanding of how it worked. And said, how does this play out? And the answer was surprisingly well. So then we're like, okay, let's reverse engineer it and actually understand what's going on. So these things are called deep convolutional neural networks. And if you don't know what a convolution was, I couldn't actually remember. I remember hearing that at one point from like special functions or something, but I Googled it. And there's a lot of useful information. So this is what a convolution looks like, you know, for discrete numbers. Suppose that you have some matrix. So this is this guy here. And I want to apply this kernel to this set of numbers. What do? I do element by element multiplication. And I'm going to sum up all the numbers. I'm going to put it into a spot here. And then I'm going to ratchet my kernel over in steps. So that's how I apply this kernel on this image. OK, good to know. If you're old enough to remember the early days of Photoshop, you'll remember that there was actually like a mode where you could start to like mess around with the blurs and stuff like that, i.e. you could play with the convolutional kernels themselves. So this is the picture of the boat that I showed you, and now I'm going to apply this kernel onto the image, and this is what my output is. And if I take the same image and I hit it with a different kernel, this is what my image is. So in deep learning, or deep convolutional neural nets at least, what you're learning are the weights of these kernels. And they're going to do a transformation from one space into another, where your final connected layer can finally do your interpolation. OK, so how well does it work? So this is what our phase transition looks like if we use sort of the exact Hamiltonian. And then the red curve here, this is what you get if you use our now deep convolutional neural net. So this is the red, looks pretty good. And actually, it turns out that you can have nets which do something called cooperative learning, where they learn to predict multiple properties simultaneously. And actually, it turns out that cooperative learning in some ways is faster than individual learning in terms of feature detection. So the green curve here is what we get for the phase transition of a two-dimensional Ising model, where we've learned both the Hamiltonian and the magnetization. OK, so good. So this was kind of the thing that had to work. Otherwise, this was a terrible idea. So the fact that this worked is sort of, OK, let's try a little, something a little harder. So then we moved on to the actual Schrodinger equation. So I said, what?
May I ask you a question? So how did you formalize the learning of Hamiltonian?
Pardon me?
I mean, how did you formalize the learning of the Hamiltonian? Like, do you learn matrix elements or what?
So this is just, I mean, this is very much a classical Hamiltonian, right? So we're saying, like, I have some spin configuration. And like, this would be the thing, like, in sort of like a first year computational course where you, you know, like, do for loops over the neighbors, sum them up, and check the spins are aligned, then I get a point. And if they're disaligned, then I lose points. Just totally classical spin Hamiltonian. Does that answer your question?
I mean, okay, for example, if you learn magnetization, okay, then I would imagine that, for example, you have a neural network where you have on the input, you have configurations of the Ising model, right? And on the output, you have a number, which is the magnetization, right?
Sure.
So, for example, here, in the case of Hamiltonian, do you also have a neural network, and what do you have on the outputs?
Energy.
So the energy of the configuration. So I put some input configuration like this. And I'm going to write out the configurational energy for that input.
So basically, you learn the energy.
Yeah. So to be clear, this is horribly inefficient. This is like, this is a terrible plan, right? We allocated like 4 GTX 1080s for a week training on a number that you could have done by hand. This was not a good computational plan. This was a proof of principle that you can, you know, these nets can be applied to map configuration to observable. Yeah. So. You know, once we had done our horrible plan, we tried to develop a less horrible plan. Can I do something a little bit more interesting? So then I said, well, okay, what would it look like if I was trying to calculate now the energy of an electron in a confining potential? So we're going to just do one electron in 2D. And the reason that we do 2D is A, it's easy to solve. And then B, it kind of hit home the point that these things are just pictures, right? So I have some well, it looks like a picture. And because it's only one electron, it's straightforward to actually write down, or rather evaluate, the Hamiltonian exactly on a grid. So we just sort of, you know, here's my tridiagonal matrix. And you know, this is easy enough to do that you can, it's basically free computationally. And so what we're going to do is we're going to generate a whole bunch of different types of confining potentials. We solve the two-dimensional Schrodinger equation. We're going to get an eigenvector. And then we're going to get an eigenvalue. This is going to be our training data. And what I want to do is I want to short circuit the connection between the potential and the ground state energy. So at this point, we start to build our own deep neural networks. So they're about 19 layers deep. And we use a combination of what we call reducing and non-reducing kernels. And it basically just goes back and forth between the reducing and the non-reducing. And the way we design them is we just sort of find this happy medium between efficiency in terms of computation time and accuracy. And just visually how these things work is, so this is my kernel. It hits my input image. And then it's going to produce some output image here, which you can either regard as a transformation, or you can kind of think of it as a feature detector. And so then the workflow looks like this. I have these potentials hit by a filter, and I want to predict out energies. And just to show you that we're operating with non-trivial wave functions, so these are kind of like the type of data that we're making predictions on. So the Vs here, so these are my electrostatic potentials. And then this would be the eigenvector resulting for that, and I'm trying to predict the eigenvalue. We actually have done some other stuff too with that I won't talk to you about today, about deep convolutional inverse graphics networks, specifically learning the mapping from V to psi squared directly. How well does it work? Pretty decently. So here what I'm plotting is predicted versus true. And this is a scatter plot for data that has not been seen during the training process. And so what you can see is that if you live on the line y equals x right here, that means that your model is doing a good job of giving you the true solution. And so why do I say that it's good? It's because we get 50% median absolute error that are plus or minus 1.5 millihartree. How do you know that's a good number? You walk down to the hall to one of your chemist friends, you say, what's a good number? And they say, well, chemical accuracy is 1.6. Good. So you declare victory. Okay, so then you take this to your boss and you say, hey, look at the cool thing I did. And they're like, this seems useless. What am I going to use this for? And you're like, right, fair enough. So at the NRC, we care about bigger stuff. It's still small, but it's bigger. One of the things that we care about are things called nanotubes. So this is an example of a nanostructure that we can kind of make. You probably heard of carbon nanotubes at one time. This is called a boron nitride nanotube.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
So in the previous example, you know the answer, so you know that basically this is how we know how fast you converge to the right answer and whether you're at the right answer or not.
Yeah.
But if you don't, how do you converge to the right answer? How many iterations do you need to do in the network to, or how many iterations of learning that you need to do to make sure that your algorithm is going to give you the right answer?
So in supervised learning, you always have some set of data that you're going to train against. Empirically, I would say you need to order 100,000 examples-ish to be able to converge a deep neural network. And you can kind of just base this just on the number of parameters that exist within it. So that's
like an empirical fact. It's not like something you can prove.
Pardon me?
Is this an empirical fact, like you try it and this is what you find, or this is something you can prove?
Yeah, it's an empirical thing, but that also sort of vaguely feels correct. Do you know what I'm saying? In as much as like, so no, I'll give you an example. So there are a number of parameters in the net. So obviously I'm going to need to have some data which is large compared to the number of parameters. So it would sort of be outrageous, actually, if I were to fit it with too few, would be my argument. And then within that, so you're look of order 100,000 pieces of data, then people have found, in terms of the optimization of your weights, maybe you need to sort of do, like, ratchet through your data. You know, they count it in terms of epochs, like 300 times. The optimization procedure is probably one which we do very inefficiently currently. You know, in principle, you should be, there's no reason that you couldn't do it faster, but at the moment you're looking, you have to cycle through and fit your data maybe like 300 epochs. But that's definitely something that people are getting better at. Again, you're always training against some known data set. I'll talk a little bit though about how to sort of go outside of that to larger systems, because that becomes actually a problem with the nanotubes. So in terms of operating on something like this, we're like, all right, now we need to get a little bit more serious. How do I deal with an atom? So the first question is, well, how do I represent an atom? And the answer is, well, let's just keep using the electrostatic potential. So this is the potential that you would say have between two atoms. And so I'm just using, you know, negative Z over R. And so again, just a toy problem. What's a simple thing that a computer can tell me about a picture of two atoms? Well, can it calculate a distance? And so if you're a human, you would say, yeah, it's easy. You just go point here, and you're going to measure between them. But the whole point of deep learning is that I'm not going to tell it how to do the thing. I just give it a whole bunch of examples. So what we do is we generate a whole bunch of examples, pictures of atoms in some box. We tell it what the distance is between them. And then we can come up with a net which learns them. Again, this is a ludicrous thing to do. You would never do this as a way of calculating the distance between two atoms. But the reason that we do it is just as a proof of principle to say, yeah, you can actually have a net learn the concept of a physical distance without even being told how to calculate it. And once you have a concept of a distance, then you can say, well, maybe I can do something a little more useful, so like an energy. So if I take the same training data that I had before, but I flip out the labels for energy, now my net can actually start to learn energy. So here I'm plotting out a little bit of a different way. So green is ground truth for the Leonard Jones potential. And then red is what my predictions are from my neural net for the total energy. And what you can see is that it does really well between 1 and 1.5 angstroms in this plot. But then beyond that, it has a hard time. And there's actually a reason for this. We artificially constrained what the training data the net had access to because we wanted to test for how well it could extrapolate outside of its training regime. And what we actually find if you go back on our distance data and constrain the training data in terms of distances, you also find that these things are not great at extrapolating. So we actually, I won't talk about it today, we actually have a way not just to return a value, but to also return a level of confidence value. And you can do something like this using a generative adversarial network. So I think in future what you're gonna have are nets that give you a number, but then also say like, you know, I feel good about this number, or maybe I don't, and you collect some more data. But how do I actually tackle this problem, right? How do I do this thing of something like this? Well, I need to generate some data. So in our case, what we did is we put together some first principles data from molecular dynamics. So these are things, so this is like graphene with 5-7 defects, missing atoms. This is a hexagonal boron nitride, so just another type of material. And then these alloyed materials. And what we did, so you can just sort of generate some data using DFT at first principles molecular dynamics to get sort of an ensemble of data. We come up with nets, so we're using the same representation of these things. And again, what we're producing is not a distance or a Leonard Jones energy, but actually an energy from density functional theory. Our predicted and true is pretty good. So this cluster down here is pure graphene. These are different mixtures of the graphene with the alloy. So in principle, you should be able to go from structure to an extensive quantity from density functional theory, but you have this problem of size. I can't generate training data on something that's this big. So to your question of like, how do you operate on sort of data that you don't have? The question is, how do I apply what I learned on a small calculation, a small system, to a very, very big one? So naively, you might say, well, I should try and divide up the problem into little chunks because I'm able to do calculations on small amounts of things. If only I was able to deal with, say, boundary conditions. But of course, you know, how do I solve that? And so our answer was actually like, well, why don't I just make this the network's problem? So what we did is the following. So we say, here's a calculation of graphene. So this is 60 atoms. This is kind of like at the limit of what you could do on a workstation. So maybe this would take you about half an hour on a 10-core machine to get a single number, like an energy. And what I do is I say, I'm going to imagine that it is possible to divide up this image into chunks. In this case, I arbitrarily declare that there will be 16 chunks. And what I'm going to say is that, okay, so if I do that, what if I just feed all of these chunks simultaneously into the network, and I tell the network that the total, the sum of the energy across this whole space is one number, energy, right? The total energy of this system. How would that work? Well, again, you have this history with boundaries. So if the network sees this chunk here of the material, and there's some sort of like local interaction between this atom and this atom, obviously it needs to have access to this information to be able to ascribe any sort of value to this thing. And so then I say, all right, well, if that's gonna work, then I probably need some context which is going to go around the piece of material so that it can answer this question. So I artificially take, and you can see it a bit more clearly here, imagine that this was my data, okay? So I have this binary set of strings here, and I wanna create a network that can look at subregions of my input vector, and I want to be able to sum those up across all of the subregions to get a single answer. If you go back to sort of like, again, the inefficient Ising model problem, how do you actually do that? You write a code, okay, that you can sort of zoom in on some area of your configuration, and you pass that function only the local neighborhood within your spin. And then that function gets applied to that neighborhood and goes into a running sum. And then you go to the next part of your thing and you apply some local neighborhood and the function goes into the sum. And so the way that we cast this problem is we're padding our data and then we say that the function, i.e. the weights of the different lanes within this net, all have to be the same. And so when we do our learning, they're all locked together. And so when you do this, you have these different regions. which are focus and context. And these become two hyperparameters within your network. So basically what that means is you need to do some experiments to figure out what makes sense. So this is us dividing it up, right? So if I take this red region, so this would be an example of focus one, context one. So I have this red region, which I put around a pad of one, same thing with the yellow. And then the network is going to apply to these data. And then we're going to get some results. So what do these numbers mean, right? So focus means that this defines, I'm going to show my network each part of this image or input data one at a time. So in this case, I'm going to say it's equal to a single domain. And then the context is how much padding that I actually put around it, how much extra data duplication I do. And you can do some experiments with this, and they actually kind of make sense. So if I set my focus equal to one and context four, what you find is that the network has difficulty converging the signal. So this is for the Ising model configuration. You're giving it more information than it needs to actually fit the total energy. And if you reduce the amount of extraneous information, so this is a constant number of learning epochs, what you find is you get the best performance on your fit when you provide it only the information that it actually needs to make the decision. Different operators have different optimal values of context. So if the operation is magnetization, you want to have a context of zero. If the operator is energy for a nearest neighbor type calculation, you want to have context one. If it's a more non-local thing, then you want to count out to the number of neighbors. And so on our best result, we find that actually, you know, if you plot the error like this, it looks terrible. But if you rescale it, the first result that I showed you where we actually got the phase transition is up here, and so using these extensive deep neural networks are actually more than an order of magnitude better. And they're actually kind of interesting in terms of what you can do in terms of learning. So now, when we start to, you know, do things like counting or total energy, we don't actually have to tell the network anything about the system. So I'll give you an example. So we trained an extensive deep neural network to learn how to count particles, but I never actually told it what a particle was. So this is training data, or example training data that we used recently. So I handed a picture like this, and then the label is 3. Then I handed a picture like this, the label is 4. This is a 6, and this is a 1. I never say what the thing is, I just say how many of those things are. This is now a test pattern that we use in terms of counting. So I don't know if you can see the red. There's a very low concentration of red random dots over here, and there's a high concentration of red dots over here. And what I'm plotting is the output per tile of the network. And you can see that it's actually learned to produce a heat map. So it has internalized this concept, this extensive quantity of number, and it can return where the value is. And now we're starting to actually apply this to the non-local operators, like an energy or an entropy or something like that. So you not only get a speed up, you can also get insight into what your system is. You can see how this thing is working as well. So this is an example of one of these tiles where I put in some random noise. So in one case, we put random noise towards the center of a tile. And you can see that the inference error goes very, very high. And then in this example here, we put the same amount of noise, but density of noise on the output of a tile. And you can see it's actually resilient to noise. So the network has actually learned the important stuff is in the middle. And that this information out here will get picked up during the next pass. OK, so now I'm showing my predicted versus true. So this is the same training set as before, but applied with extensive deep neural networks. The error on this is equal to the error of density functional theory itself. You literally can't get any better than this. So there's uncontrolled approximations in DFT, and we're at that error with this method. Why is this useful? Well, one of the reasons is scaling. So I mentioned that you can do a calculation. Maybe it'll take you half an hour on a 10-core workstation for this sort of 60-atom cell. If you were to double the system size with DFT, things scale as order n cubed. And so maybe it'll take you a day to do 240 atoms. If you, you know, say, I want to go up to a large system, which is still small in terms of material, say 1,500 atoms, it'll take you about 1,000 cores for 2 days to get a single number. If you use our method of extensive deep neural networks, you can get the same answer that it's a million times faster. And importantly, the scaling along here is actually order n. Because what you've effectively done is you've removed all of those long-range interactions that are only actually in DFT because of the basis sets that you use. So despite the fact that quantum mechanics is non-local, Walter Cohn actually said, you know, matter is short-sighted. Like an electron here, if there's a whole bunch of stuff in the middle, really doesn't care about what's going on far away. How's the accuracy? So here is compared against ground truth. So red is the DFT solution, and then E is our training model. And it's basically spot on. So what we've started doing now in our group is say, well, let's start looking at some mesoscale materials. So this is highly defected graphene, and I'm zooming out. So this is a calculation that we were able to do. It has 135,000 atoms, and it takes about 3 minutes on a GPU to result. So this is easily the largest DFT calculation or DFT result that's ever been done. The other thing that I should mention in terms of these methods is that they naturally actually are able to handle multiscale interactions. So this, everything that I've talked about to this point is basically on sort of covalent bond type stuff. But if you have something where you have non-local interactions or things that are far away, you can actually just do a scaling factor. In the last 10 minutes, I want to tell you about something that's a little bit different, which is relatively new in my group, but it's sort of fun. So
just to make it clear, so for example, in the case of graphene, you basically learn how to get energies of large lattices if you know energies of small lattices, right?
Yeah.
This is what the neural network is for.
Pardon? Yeah. Yeah, so this, exactly. And so you can look at basically structures which are, you know, so long as you can capture a motif within the length scale that you can simulate, you can do any kind of any version of that with no repeating or anything. It's not just a trick.
Can I ask you?
Sure.
How do your predictions compare, for instance, as if you like if you do it like without considering any interaction at all? Like if you just sum the energies of the different patches, with your neural network.
So in the blue case here, this DFT, in principle, this includes any distance of interaction. This would be across the whole cell. And then the red is the result that we get where you're including the interactions. Normally, you can't actually ascribe an energy to an individual area, right? It's not a well-defined concept.
Okay.
But to within the largest calculation that we can do, they're well within chemical accuracy.
But for instance, if you take a system which is the size of a patch, of your patches, and then you just simulate many of them and then you use those energies that you get and then you sum them up, how does this compare with the ED and N?
So you mean you split up the large system into chunks and then just go compute the energy as if it was additive?
Yeah.
And then compare to the networks of the
I'm just curious.
So where it comes in, so let's say that I did this small thing. So I need to do a realistic simulation of a small amount of material, right? So suppose that this was my unit cell right here, this 6-atom. When I do a simulation of a periodic system of a crystal of this, I'm not doing a simulation of just this small amount of material. I'm doing a forever replicating version of it. And so I don't really get the energy of this thing. I get the energy of that entire infinite series of those things. Whereas an EDNN will actually let you have like this guy next to someone who has a different kind of defect. Right? And so you can get to a different sort of length scale in terms of the repeat unit, I guess, for lack of a better word. So you wouldn't get the same answer, right? In terms of the two of them. Yeah.
How do these optimization algorithms scale with the number of processors?
So you have a fixed amount of data.
The same problem on 10 CPUs instead of 5, and how long will it take you?
What is the formal scheme?
I don't know if it's parallel or not.
So inference is trivially parallel. So when you're actually running it on your thing, that's trivial parallel. Actually, we've done some tests. We're gearing up to do some tests on Cori, which is the number 8 supercomputer in the world. So we're going to run a giant thing on Cori. So inference is trivially parallel. Training is not, right? So actually, like using a large number of processors on training and getting that like I can't remember what the formal big O notation is on it, but it's difficult actually to get efficient train, because you have to basically like move. It's complicated is the short answer, and I don't remember. Normally what we do is we train on what I'll call small system sizes. So maybe we use like 4 GPUs or something like that on a data set, but our inference is using like 10,000. Okay. So the last thing that I will briefly touch on, So for the last number of years, a friend of mine, Steve Whitelum, so he's at Berkeley. Steve's a clever guy, and he's done a lot of stuff with self-assembly. And he's been nice enough to let me kind of go along for the ride. And the stuff that we've been working on together is basically, how do you make something nanoscale into something big, all right? So like, we kind of talk about nanotechnology and it's going to be useful and all this stuff, but like in day-to-day life, the only place where people actually are exposed to it are computer chips, right? So, you know, everybody's got a laptop here. That's a nanoscale device. And currently it costs like a couple $1 billion in building to be able to make like a tiny amount of dye in terms of CPU space. And so what people want to do is they say, well, how can I make sort of things that are encoded with interesting nanoscale properties, but at a mesoscopic scale? And so the solution to a lot of people think of this is something called self-assembly, where you basically let the system naturally grow into something that's useful. And so Steve and I have been kind of, you know, playing around, again, me following Steve, on guided self-assembly. So you want to sort of have a system evolve into some, you know, basically grow into something useful. And so this kind of got me thinking, I'm like, I wonder if you can do something useful in this field using this other AI stuff. So humor me for a minute, because recently I was asked to give a talk. I think this is a joke that they play on new adjuncts. So I got adjunct status at U Ottawa, and they said, we'd like you to give a festive talk at the December thing. And I was like, all right, I can do festive. So I was totally the only guy that did it. Anyway, so I'm going to give you, so this is sort of a model story, but we'll give you a flavor of kind of what we're also working on at the moment. So at some point, someone told you that, you know, chemical reactions happen and there's these different rate constants. Okay, fine. You can turn something like this into a set of coupled differential equations, right? So, you know, when people in chemistry talk about sort of like a first order rate kinetics, this is what they mean. So me, in my attempt of being festive, I said, all right, I'm going to talk about some Christmas trees and I'm going to talk about some candles, okay? And then I realized when I submitted the abstract that people might have the wrong idea of what I meant. So I'm not talking about burning, no, I'm going to give you two different things. So, and why are we talking? Because we're using reinforcement learning. So how can you use reinforcement learning in problems of chemical kinetics and self-assembly? This is one of the things my group is working on. And you always need a catchy title, so we call it self-driving chemistry or self-driving physics. We got logos and everything. Okay. So what is reinforcement learning? Reinforcement learning is a subclass of machine learning or AI. I've lost track of the names, doesn't matter, where you have some environment and you have an agent. And so the agent, what does it do? It can observe the environment, it can take some action, and ultimately it's trying to do a good thing, okay? It has some goal in mind. And so this, like, you know, the AlphaGo and the Atari and all this stuff, that's what those are. So reinforcement learning is actually a very old idea in computer science. It's just when people started coupling it with these deep learning methods that we saw the explosion. And so I can show you how we've started to do this in chemical kinetics, again, with a ridiculous model. So suppose that you have some seeds for your Christmas trees and you have some space. Then, you know, the seeds plus space is going to go forward. There's some rate constant associated with that that's going to produce a new sapling. And if I have some sapling plus food and water, there's some other rate constant which is going to produce a tree and new seeds. This defines a set of coupled differential equations, which are this. And what I want to do is I want to let my reinforcement learning agent make me a lot of trees. Because why are we thinking of this? Well, this is kind of like a game, right? You know, we know that deep reinforcement learning, or just reinforcement learning agents, are good at games. And we think, what is a game? A game is something where you know what success looks like. In this case, make a lot of tree. But I don't necessarily know what the policy or the approach is to achieve success. So in this case, make me some trees. And this is a very simple agent, but you can see that it's kind of working. So it's playing through these games. And so right now, what has it done? It's in very quickly, it learns that I need to increase the rate constant, this K1. And then it decides that I'm going to go after a K2. And after a couple hundred episodes, it learns how to max out the game, where in this case, I guess it's, reforesting or something like this. Now, this is a sort of a very trivial game, because you can just say, this is like an easy optimization problem, and you can brute force it. And actually, we had a pretty, not even a very intelligent agent, because it kind of walked this way and walked this way. But you get the general idea, right? Like, we want to take an agent, I want to connect it to a chemical physical process, and ideally, I want to do it one where I don't know what the solution is. I don't necessarily know how to turn the knobs, but I know what success is. And so then here's another example. This time it's burning candles. I guess we have a certain amount of wax and oxygen. To be fair, this was one of these cases where the supervisor asks for the slides like literally the night before. And it's like, so Rory did a good job, all right? So here we are. Similar story. So you can see that the agent is learning how to max out the game. And again, in this case, it took sort of a weird path, but it got there. So all I really want to say on this is that what we're doing in this other effort is we're basically trying to put everybody in chemistry synthesis out of a job. Okay, and so what do we do? So we want to make sort of a smart thermostat, where this might mean your pressure, your temperature, whatever. And we want to couple this into physical observations that one might make. So XRD, maybe you would do some TGA analysis. And I want to have this smart AI make decisions about how to make stuff based on games that it's played. And so the games that we're coding up are based on sort of standard physics that we know. And ultimately, this thing is going to teach us how to make some cool new stuff. So this is the other area that we're working on. So I'll end here. And basically, so hopefully I convinced you. I think the point with these, what I've started calling deep models, is that, what we have sort of been doing in terms of electronic structure, you can kind of see hitting a wall. And I don't mean that in a terrible way, but just to give you a story. So when I was doing my PhD, the scale of systems that you can address now versus even 10 years ago, they're not that much bigger, right? Like, computers have gotten bigger, but it's not that much bigger. And the algorithms have gotten bigger, but they're not that much better. And I'm going to make an argument that it's like progress has been linear. Maybe a little bit better than linear, but it's only linear. Conversely, if you kind of look at what's going on in the deep learning field, everything is ridiculously, it's exponential and it is accelerating. And so I kind of had an argument about this recently where someone says, no, there's been so much progress. And so I don't want this message to be misunderstood. There has been progress in what I'll call conventional algorithm development. But I think if we kind of like look across the street, to what's going on in the AI field, it is astonishing how quickly this stuff is moving forward. And so if we want to kind of like grab onto a bit of exponential growth, I think it actually makes sense to start thinking about how we do conventional electronic structure and modeling, not as like the end solution. This is how we're going to generate data that we're going to put into our deep models, and then the deep models are going to carry us the rest of it. Not till the end of time, but at least for the next 10 years. And everything, at least in my opinion, it kind of points that way. So if you look at like the roadmaps that like NVIDIA and all the big supercomputing companies are putting out, it actually, like, chips have plateaued. They don't get that much faster. Interconnects are not getting that much faster. But the ability to ingest huge amounts of numbers, like data, and do inference, like, it really is exponential growth. So deep models, in my opinion, are anything where you can sort of generate some good data that you trust, and then lets you go to, say, a much larger system or to a much longer time scale, so that you can actually, start to get at some of the things that we're interested in. So thank you all very much for your attention, and it's nice to be here today.
Questions?
They're all sold. Believe it.
So all the icing model type stuff you did, those are all thermal systems, not quantum ones, right?
Yeah, totally.
So the only quantum system was the single electron.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it depends on whether or not you believe the density functional theory. So, I mean, in DFT, is, you know, quantum mechanical at the level of the electrons, right?
That's some sort of mean field approximation, isn't it?
So formally DFT is exact. In practical terms, there is currently, so how does DFT work? So there is an exact mapping, and there exists some unknown functional, which, if you have it, will give you all information from the ground state electron density. In practice, we don't have that thing, so we come up with approximations for it, and through that making of approximations, then you break the exactness. So you can say it's mean field in as much as many approximations will invoke some level of mean field, but the method itself is in principle exact. In the same way that it's like most quantum mechanical methods are, I mean, so take like variational quantum Monte Carlo. People say, oh, it's exact. And you're like, oh, well, what about your wave function ansatz? And like, what about the Jastrow factor, right? So DFT lives in a similar vein, but in practical applications, it's inexact, even though it has a formal basis.
So, but like, right. I guess I'm just, how does the, how are these entangled? Is there,
Right, so, I mean, I live in a world of condensed matter where there's lots of screening. So am I dealing with like highly entangled particles? No, definitely not. I live in sort of chemical bonds, covalent bonds, just
so
kind of.
Possibly some kind of low entanglement approximation.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Can you say something about QED or electron? You said electrodynamics. Does that mean QED or what did you mean? It's just on the slide.
So I think I would argue that application of deep neural networks to make, I can't remember what was on my slide, but application of deep neural networks to approximating existing physical models is probably very broad. So these things are surprisingly good.
Did you mean quantum field theory?
No. Where did we see this in my slide?
I think you meant classical electrodynamics.
You meant classical electrodynamics?
That sounds like something I would have said. Yeah. So computational electrodynamics. So I'm talking about things like where people do, like basically things that run on like a DOE supercomputer. So where you have like some magneto hydrodynamics code where you're trying to understand like, you know, what things look like in very complicated environments, right? Exactly. I think that this kind of thing is, yeah, very general and should work for this. And again, I don't want to say that like we're definitely, like don't throw away that your partial differential equations. But implicitly when we operate numerically, we make all these approximations in terms of sort of the time scales and the length scales that we can address because of the limitations of what we do in a computer. And I actually think that in some cases, deep neural networks might actually, you pay a price in terms of like they're only approximate, but I think that they get around some of those other issues, especially in terms of things like if you're designing a material and you want to do search and so on and so forth. So that's what I meant there.
Has there ever been a case where it's deep learning or something in neural networks solves a problem or predicted an answer which was then confirmed by more traditional methods? You know what I mean?
So
and you train it on something, you know the answer.
Yeah.
You did an extrapolation, did it work so much?
Sure. So I think I'm failing to think of a current example because it's a relatively new field, but I'll give you a very old example if that works. So van der Waals in his PhD thesis argued that you could come up with an equation of state which had two parameters, right? The radius of an atom and the long range interaction of the atom. So he created two features based on some physical intuition which he then came up with a model, which came up with an equation of state, which resulted in a phase transition. And if you sort of follow through with the idea of sort of force fields and phenomenological fitting, much of 20th century physics, especially when you deal with things like proteins or any of this kind of stuff, was always based on, yes, we know the equations, right? Like Dirac wrote it down, thank you. But fundamentally, we need to create some features, we need to collect some data, and we need to do some fits. And so we were able to answer a lot of questions based on our ability to tackle more complicated systems. And so what deep learning gets for you is it helps you, if you're not van der Waals, it helps you figure out what the A and the B might be based on your data. And then once you have done that interpretation, you look at what the net sees, you go, oh, okay, I kind of understand where that feature came from. And then it lets you do more challenging problems. So that's my long-winded answer to your question.
You're telling us what it's good for, basically.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if, I think what might impress people a lot would be if it solved a problem that someone else couldn't solve, and then it was confirmed, it gives the right answer.
Well, I mean, I guess I would argue that, so I guess we, in some sense, we show this in terms of our, like, you can't do electronic structure theory at that scale.
Right, so how do you know you got it right?
Because the largest system I can conceivably do, it works. So much, much larger. So this gets into a philosophical thing. Like, it works at, you know, what about, is 10 men enough, God? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. So. How do I? I'm not even sure I can figure out that test case, right?
The question is, if you show something by using these algorithms, how do you? You show something that was not accessible before. You solve a problem that was not solvable before. So the question is, of course, how to confirm the solution?
Sure. I mean, I guess my terrible answer would be, well, I came up with the calculation for the large system before we ran it on VAST, but it, you know, you could have done that yourself.
An analogy to like a convergence test you could do or something?
Well, no, I mean, this is the...
No. Yeah. Absolutely. Because
I mean, I'll phone a friend here. Roger, what do you think? Roger's like, we're not friends.
Every time I give this talk, I get the same question. So we should think of how to answer it.
Well, no, and I'm happy to crowdsource the answer, right? So here, I mean, this is the thing I do, right? So let's suppose I didn't own a very large computer, okay? All of my testing and training would have been at these small length scales. And then I say, this is what I think the behavior of graphene will be at, you know, what is this, like an order of magnitude larger? And then someone goes out and buys a computer that's expensive, and then we test it, and then we get the same answer. So, I mean, in some sense, that's done on this chart, right?
Yeah, if you did that first, if the red dot was done before the blue dot.
I mean, it was done like a day before, but yeah.
No,
yeah. So in that case, yeah, no, very much so. So the blue, like the red dot was like this, and this were all definitely done before the blue dots. And the reason that they were done is because, you know, we're making these red dots, and I'm like, let's go big. And then I say to the students, I'm like, man, no one's ever going to believe us if we just say, oh, yeah, it's good to go. So then I'm like, where can we find a big computer? And they have one in Toronto. And so I was like, well, let's burn some CPU time. And that's where the blue dots come from. Now, I don't consider this to be a great physical insight. You know what I mean? You've calculated an energy. But definitely, yeah, there was no prior knowledge of the large system.
It looks flat. Is that just the way you plotted it?
This is the total energy per atom as a function of system size. I can plot it in a nice, so it's an extensive property, so it shouldn't change. And so then, you know, I'm plotting here the error on these things.
So is it because the correlation length is way shorter than the size of the system?
Absolutely, yeah. So this is where I have to, and I get this at NRC too. They're like, oh, but it's quantum and everything is non-local. And I'm like, no, it's not. Like, honestly, like an electron, things can be non-local, but metals don't care, right? Like screening lengths, it's not actually that far. On a lot of materials, you know, if you wiggle here, the material a couple angstroms over does not care that happened. Matter is surprisingly nearsighted. Now, it's not always like that. You can come up with, and it's frankly interesting when it's not, but a lot of things are very local. And so what we're dealing with is materials which are, the locality length scale is smaller compared to this. And to be clear, this whole idea of domain decomposition, this would not work if it wasn't for that, right? If you had, like, you know, here's one electron and an empty universe and another electron, your deep neural network wouldn't be able to divide that up. You couldn't actually break your scaling. Otherwise, you'd be violating a lot of things. So,
yeah. I guess the question is, like, how do you know that your algorithm doesn't need more training when you go to larger scale, larger number of atoms in this case, for instance?
Well, again, it has to do with the nature of the interaction, right? We're talking, I mean, so all right. Hold on. I'll give you an example. So ultimately, for this type of system, it's covalently bonded material, right? When you talk about a covalently bonded material, what do we think the impact of this covalent bond is on that one 64 nanometers away? And the answer is it's in the noise. It's screened out. And these are things that you can measure it, you can show it. The correlation length of electrons in a screened material is not infinite, at least at the level of energy that we're talking about here. Right? I'm not saying that quantum effects can't last, you know, go that far, or you couldn't have an exciton length or something. I'm not saying anything about, I'm just saying that if you jiggle an atom there, this guy does not feel it in practical terms.
Yeah, so how is that different than from doing a small scale periodic system?
Pardon me?
How is that different from doing just a small scale periodic system?
So the difference with a small periodic system is that then I would only ever be studying, so for instance, let's say that you wanted to study something like tearing this material apart. Right? So this is a thing that people care about for fractures. How would you do a long length scale perturbation on a system if you can only look at small periodic systems? You can't do it. So what this solves for you is basically it does the domain decomposition down to the point where you get sort of covalent interactions, but then it actually lets you pull in your sort of what I'll call the atomic scale information into a much larger scale interaction.
Would it be fair to say that the kind of application that this will certainly work for is where you have already a physical understanding and you have some algorithm in some way of solving the problem at one scale, and this allows you to scale it up more
yes.
efficiently?
Absolutely,
much
yeah.
better than,
yes.
But if you lack that first step, then you can't use it. Is that fair?
That is absolutely fair, yeah. Yeah, so all I would sell a deep model for is like, this is the way that you take information from a small scale and then bring it up to a larger scale. Yes, which is a grand challenge problem for a lot of things.
But, as long as the correlation length is short enough, right?
Yes, and importantly, it tells you if it's not, right? The correlate, like I don't tell it what the correlation length is. So if it can't come up with a solution, that's actually an indication that your correlation length is long compared to what you're simulating, right? So you don't have to key it in ahead of time, but yes.
So at some point, if you make it even bigger, like nothing new is going to happen, right?
So, pardon me?
Like if you double that size again, supposing you have the resources to do that, at some point, whatever you're measuring is not going to care that you did that, right?
So yes, until you start thinking about like protein folding.
Yeah, so I mean, pick a problem.
Yeah.
And then you could do something like a convergence test is what I'm arguing.
Yep.
By scaling the system up until
yep.
the answer didn't change. And that would be a way of showing that your answer was right. Or at least that it was converted.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So.
Great. Let's ponder the question of machine supremacy a little bit years later. Isaac's here all day, and maybe tomorrow if he doesn't get it. Let's thank him again.
Thank you.